Hi, I'm Gabriela Cámara, and you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb. You're the bomb.
Hi, Bomb Squad. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Each week, we talk to the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. Let's thank our sponsor, Hansenbrook Farm Pasture-Raised Organic Eggs. Hansenbrook Farm's secret to making rich, flavorful eggs is simple. The most possible space, the best possible feed, and lots of love. It's a healthy and humane recipe that makes your omelets, cakes, custards, and everything in between taste better. Want to get cracking? Of course you do. Visit hansenbrookfarm.com. All right, it's housekeeping time. The Radio Cherry Bomb team is back on the road for our Food for Thought tour, presented by Kerrygold. Check out cherrybomb.com for all the details and come hang out with us. We would love to see you as we bring Radio Cherry Bomb to life in cities across the country. Since summer is right around the corner, we're kicking off a fun sustainability project called Cone Only. When you visit an ice cream shop this summer, skip the cup and skip the spoon. Get a cone. It's zero waste. Be sure to take a picture for Instagram and use the hashtag #ConeOnly. We'll share all the best pictures of your cool scoops. Help spread the word and make this the most sustainable summer yet. And thank you to our project partners, the Surf Rider chapters in NYC and Long Island. That's hashtag #ConeOnly. So who's on today's show? It's the cult cookbook author from Australia, Hetty McKinnon. Hetty's newest book, Family, came out last month, and it's as warm and wonderful as she is. You can hear my conversation with Hetty right after this word from our sponsor. Hansenbrook Farm believes that organic and pastured is the way to go when it comes to eggs. Pasture-raised means better lives for hens, better lives for small farmers, and better eggs for you. It's also better for chefs who depend on rich, flavorful eggs. Hansenbrook Farm's own flock of amazing chefs, their mother hens, count on it. Inat Admini is a mother hen. She's also the celebrated chef behind Taim, Balabusta, and Kish Kash in Manhattan. Want to learn how Chef Inat whips up her red shakshuka, an aromatic spicy tomato sauce into which she nestles eggs and lets them poach to perfection? You can find Chef Inat's Middle Eastern egg-centric recipes and videos on hansenbrookfarm.com. You can find their eggs at Publix, Kroger, Sprouts Farmers Market, Fresh Direct, and many natural food stores across the country. Are you ready for Hetty? Here's our chat. Hetty, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
I don't even know where to begin, so we're just going to go back to when you were a kid, because that tends to be the easiest thing. Were you born in Australia?
I was born in Australia.
Which part?
In Sydney.
Oh, in Sydney.
Yeah, suburban Sydney.
What was life like for little Hetty?
You know, it's funny. I've thought a lot about this as I've gotten older and as I've had my own kids. It was like a very traditional Chinese upbringing. My parents are both from the south of China. They immigrated in, my dad in his teens, my mum in her early 20s. So we, at home, I was Chinese. We spoke Chinese. We ate Chinese food. It was all Chinese customs and lighting incense every morning. And then I'd go to school and I'd somehow have to be Australian. So that's something I've thought about a lot as I've gotten older, is kind of caught in those, living in two worlds. My mum doesn't speak English very much at all. And she tried to assimilate the best she could. And my childhood was all about food. And my mum cooked all day. And if she wasn't cooking, she was shopping for food, preparing food for the next day. And she would make us these huge breakfasts. So it'd be like fried rice or noodles or this macaroni dish that she used to do with pasta in a sauce. And so I'd get to school and really not want to eat for the rest of the day. So I remember there was, when I was in what we call infant school, which is like lower elementary school, the teachers would come to me and say, why didn't you bring some food for, because we'd have a break at about 11 o'clock, why didn't you bring food for little lunch? And I didn't really know how to answer that. So they would give me money to buy like little biscuits from the what we call the canteen, because they thought that I was don't know, maybe I was being neglected at home, but they didn't quite understand that we'd eaten this huge breakfast at 8:30 in the morning. So food was a huge part of growing up, which...
Did your mom enjoy that?
She was an immigrant who never got a job, who never was... She finished school at 14. And I think there's a huge element of my mum who's... I think we're very much alike. Mm-hmm. Like, she never had the chance to study or become that other person. So I think for her, being in the home, food was her domain. That was where she could really express herself and, like, show her love to her family, was through cooking. So
how did she wind up in Australia?
She went to Australia to marry my dad.
So was it an arranged marriage?
Yeah, it was an arranged marriage. Most of the marriages, even in her generation, were arranged. And it's funny because she had a choice of two men. She'd kill me if she knew I was telling the story, but she doesn't really understand, so that's okay. She had a choice of two men. One was in Sydney. And my dad's family was from the same village, so they knew of his family. And the other man was in Hawaii, and she chose my dad. But I guess there's a little bit element of fate involved, because my dad died actually when I was 15, and this man in Hawaii also died around a similar time. So it was almost like my mum was destined to be a widow. And even though she was in her... like, she was 44 when my dad died. And in many respects, she came into her own. She had to learn at that age to go to a bank for the first time, how to get around. Like, my dad used to drive her everywhere to go get her food. So she'd go have to, oh, I now have to get on a bus or a train, sometimes both, to get to that brand of tofu that she liked. It was an incredible, like, I was 15 at the time. So
how did that impact you? Because you were the one who understood Australian life better.
I mean, I think it really underscored a lot of my childhood and probably who I am today, is that great sense of, I mean, in Chinese culture, there's a big sense of responsibility for elders anyway, but I think in our family, it was heightened, and probably more so for my brother and sister, because they were older than me. And so they took on the responsibility of looking after her. So I was too. I was still at home, but I was, like, still in high school, and I think she held everything in. I think I used to hear her crying in the bathroom, but she would never show us that she was sad or afraid, because Chinese people love to keep face. You know, you've got to show how brave you are outwardly. But I think that is really kind of... I've always been very driven, but I think that maybe that actually made me more driven, because life is short, you got to appreciate the people around you, and you have a short amount of time to make something happen. And I was always a very good kid, like, very responsible. Like, I never really played up. I, you know, did well at school, went to university, was the first person in my family to go to university and all that stuff. So I think that really did affect, you know, my relationship with my family and the kind of who I am today, that sense of responsibility. And not only really doing something if I think I'm going to be proud of it.
That's a good way to go through life. Did you feel like you were living two different lives as a teenager?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, all through my life, really, up until now. I think being in New York has been a really positive thing for me, I think, for the first time. And I guess being in food.
How did you wind up in America?
So I've always had this New York dream, not particularly American dream, nothing against America.
A lot of Australians have that dream.
Yeah, but the New York was always this, even before it was that cool. I mean, my husband and I in our mid-20s wanted to come to New York. We came here on a vacation and just kind of fell in love with New York. So we both entered the green card lottery. And in that time, my husband got an opportunity to move to London. So we thought, okay, we're probably never going to get this. And so we took the opportunity. We arrived in London, and this was in the early 2000s. And my brother called one day and said, oh, Ross has mail from Kentucky. And I'm like, you're kidding me. So he'd won the green card lottery, but we had literally just landed in London. I didn't have a job yet, but he'd been there. He'd been moved over for a job. So we were like, we can't take this. We have to stay in London. So we ended up staying in London, and for 4 years we loved it. And my oldest was actually born there, but then we decided to move back to Sydney. So moving back to Sydney, it was a beautiful time, and that's when I kind of fell into food. But my husband is a lawyer, so he got offered to come to New York. And at that particular time, I thought, he assumed that I wouldn't do it because Community, my first book, had just come out. It was doing really well. And I was at that point where I was just about to take the next step. Like, Arthur Street Kitchen was a business I ran at home, and I couldn't even handle the orders and everything that was coming at me. And I was just about at that juncture to, what do I do? Do I open a cafe? I didn't really want to open a cafe, but I didn't know what the next step was. And so when he threw this New York dream at me, I was like, let's do it. I mean, three kids. I'm like, you know, Kerry, I think there's a part of me that loves to start again. And I've said this a few times, I really love the struggle. Like, I love being at the bottom of the ladder and climbing and working towards something. I'm very uncomfortable with getting to the top of the ladder. So I saw it as such an exciting opportunity just to, like,
so you weren't harboring these dreams of being the next Donna Hay or something?
No, okay. Never. Okay. I mean, I love Donna Hay. I think she's just such a pioneer of everything, like food, photography, styling.
If you're listening and you don't know who Donna Hay is, please look her up. She's
an icon.
You could say she's the Martha Stewart of Australia, but in a way I feel like that's not fair because her aesthetic, I think, inspired so much of the American food scene, and people don't even know it.
I think she really changed the way food is photographed. You know,
100%.
Yeah, I mean, I think after her books came out, her early books, people were shocked. And I think then you started seeing blogs happen. And I think her style was the precursor to all of that.
Yeah, her influence, she doesn't get the credit she deserves. Maybe she does in Australia, but in America, she does not. A lot of people don't even know about her.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. I think the people in the food, some people in the food industry have asked about her, but yeah, she's pretty big in Australia.
We would love to have her come to Jubilee or something.
She would love that.
Oh, you could interview her.
Yeah,
that'd
love
be fun.
That.
Let's make that happen.
Yes, for sure.
Putting it out in the universe, like Padma and Madhur, like that. That's been in the works for a long time.
Yeah,
and we could just never make schedules work, and now it's happening.
Oh, that's amazing! Mm-hmm. I used to deliver to Donna's office, actually.
You did?
Yeah, the editor of her magazine. She actually lived in Carroll Gardens for a while, but now she's in Eastern, Melanie Hanschke.
Oh, I think I've met her. Yeah,
she's
lovely. She might have been the one who told me about you.
Oh, probably.
Is that possible?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so we have to go back because you've said all these things that you do. So you're in London, you go back to Sydney. When did Arthur Street Kitchen start? Tell us the timeline of the books, the business, all that.
Yeah, so I used to work in PR. So when I was in Australia and then I went to London, I worked in PR agency. And my oldest was born in London, and I kind of I knew straight away I didn't really want to go back to that life. I wanted to move back to Sydney. I had this great calling to be close to my mum. So I did that. And then I had two more children in very quick succession. They're all under 2 years apart. So I have three children. And for many years, I just was in a daze. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I was so tired all the time. And then when my third child was about one, it was like kind of time I was freelancing again for a PR agency.
I love that admission that for a few years you were in a daze.
I had no idea. I still don't remember much of the kids when they were babies. My mum tells me it'll come back later on in life, but I'm still waiting because you're living in the now. You know, when you have children, it's all about now. Like, how could I get through the next 2 hours or whatever? You know, it's joyous too. It's not all bad, but it's hard. So I was offered a job when my youngest was one and in PR. And for me, that was really crunch times. Like, do I go back on the road that I was already traveling down, or do I take a far left turn? And I was really grasping. I think I was grasping a little bit. It's like, oh, I really like cooking. Like, during the time that my kids were young, every time they went down for a nap, I would get out Ottolenghi's book and his original book, like not even Plenty, which is the one I love, but his original book. And I just learned his recipes are really complicated. So they would take me hours. But the good thing about that is that I would learn a lot about flavor. So he would do things like toast the coriander seeds and the cumin seeds and then put it in a mortar and pestle and then grind it up. And I will admit, I don't do that now. I would just use pre-ground coriander seeds and pre-ground cumin.
You're a monster. You use pre-ground cumin? Oh my God.
Terrible, right?
I'm kidding.
But I learned a lot about flavor. I learned a lot about technique and how to put things together. And so from that point, I really love cooking. And before that, even though I grew up with food all around me, I never loved cooking like that.
You weren't helping your mom.
I wasn't, because in Chinese culture, you really don't. You observe. I asked her once how she learned to cook, and she said, oh, I just stood in the corner and watched her elders. So it would be her aunts and, you know, great aunts. They all lived together. So I didn't really cook when I was younger. When I was about in my late teens, I became vegetarian. So I would dab.
Because?
Oh, look, I think it was mainly a taste thing. Like I remember smelling, my dad was having a barbecue when I was in my younger teens, and I remember being repulsed by the smell of it. But now, like, my vegetarianism, it's not something I shout from the rooftops, like, all my food is vegetarian, but I also want my food to be inclusive. So I don't brand it as vegetarian food, really. I am trying to change people's ways, though, and by showing people how to cook really delicious vegetarian food, it's going to have less impact on the environment. You know, the less meat that's eaten, the better it is. So that's kind of my long-term legacy, Kerry, is getting there with getting people to eat more delicious vegetarian food. Getting back to Arthur Street Kitchen. So at that point, I decided, look, maybe I had just had this crazy idea one day with a friend. I was like, oh, I might actually just start making like salads and putting them in a box and just delivering them around the neighborhood. Do you think that's a good idea? Because the area where I lived, it was a place called Surry Hills in Sydney. It's like the food capital of Sydney. It's got all the best restaurants. And people were like, I don't think you can buy salads around here. Not takeaway salads. So I just started. It was on a whim. There was no business plan. No real long-term goals at all. I just ordered boxes and started making exactly the type of food that I was making for myself.
Did you know about things like cost of goods?
Oh,
those
nothing.
Kinds of things, yeah.
Nothing. I mean,
it's like when we interviewed the granola girls and they were like making their first batches of granola and buying like the best honey, the best this and that. And they were like, cost of goods, 100%.
Well, I would buy really expensive ingredients. I think to this day, The funny thing about Arthur Street Kitchen is it was an accidental business. It was never meant to be a business, and I still now struggle to call it a business. So when I write about it or people ask me questions, to call it a business just feels wrong, because it wasn't why I did it. I knew I just love to cook and I just love to feed people, and so the joy that I saw on people's faces when I delivered a salad to their door was what fueled me. So it was never like about collecting the money, or, you know, I didn't have, it was very low-fi. You know, I would email a menu on a Wednesday and people would just email me with what they wanted. So it was
sounds so nice.
And, you know, like through the business, I taught myself to cook, because I couldn't really, I'm not a trained chef. Everything I know is through just cooking myself. And you know, now I didn't know how to write recipes back then. It was just all like just by accident and just taking chances and taking risks and seeing what worked, what didn't. Some salads were better than others. And
so how did the first cookbook come about?
So about a year into delivering salads, people would ask me, I really want to make that blood orange dressing this weekend for friends. Can you send me the recipe? So I'd go home and there's no recipe. But then I had to like teach myself to write recipes. And so I would write recipes and email them. And I was doing that for many months, maybe a year. And then there was this one day, it was like the turning point when I was delivering salads. People would say to me, you should write a cookbook. And it was this one day when four different people said it to me for no apparent reason. It was like a happy coincidence. And so I went home, I was like, I'm going to write a cookbook. So I worked on this. I had to, in that process, teach myself how to write a recipe, teach myself about having kind of my own house style, like all these elements that you take for granted when you're just in the kitchen cooking, how to write a recipe that makes sense. And as a home cook, I guess I was probably at an advantage because I kind of understood what it's like to cook in a home kitchen. And so over a year, I wrote these recipes. And I mean, a lot of this is serendipity. I think serendipity is the word to really sum up almost everything that's happened to me in my career. I'll use career as in air quotes, because things just kind of happened and just at the right time.
I feel the same way about my life.
It's incredible. Mm-hmm. Just as I'd finished my manuscript, there's an Australian online newspaper called Broadsheet, and they said, we want to do a story about you. So they sent a photographer called Louisa Brimble, and she walks. Yeah,
she did that cookbook we love, Wild.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And she walks in, and I was cutting sweet potato, which is her favorite vegetable, and she was just, you know, I think you've met her. She's she's so colorful, and she's just, I want to shoot a cookbook. Let's do it. And she was like, you know, so excited. I'd never met her before, and I was like, yeah, actually, I've just finished writing a manuscript. And she literally went home, and she'd never shot a cookbook before. This photography was still quite new to her at that stage. And she sent me a schedule, said, this is when I'm free in the next 2 months. And we just did it. She came over. We had no idea what we were doing. It was all in my house. I didn't have a stylist. And she said, I got a message from this girl. Her name's Erica. She wants to come to help us on the shoot. And it wasn't that she wasn't meant to be the stylist. So I was like, okay, she can come. So Erica turns up first day. She ended up styling the whole book and my other two books too. So it's the same team. We've been together for many years now.
That's wonderful. Did you decide to try to find a publisher because you self-published the first book?
Yes. No. See, again, Kerry, it was never meant to be this book. It was meant to be just for my customers. But because I love paper and I love printed, I love books. So I thought, I'm going to do it properly. So I went. I almost spent 6 months researching paper, having meetings, getting quotes, getting mock-ups, samples made, dummy books made up with the paper stock that I wanted. And then I found this printer in Hong Kong that I worked with, and I was really happy. So I just thought, I'm just going to do this myself. It's a vanity project. Let's be honest. I printed 1,000 copies, and I thought, I'm going to have these in my living room for the...
So it's almost like a marketing tool.
Yeah.
For you.
For my whole life, yeah. I'm going to have these. You know, I priced it at $38 because 8 is a lucky number in, you know, no, I don't think any publisher would ever, you know, price something at $38. That had meaning to me. So it was like I could do all these things, and it was just this wonderful, the whole experience was just so fun, and we had a great team of women working on it. It was wonderful. And so somehow the book comes out and it sold out in 3 weeks.
It's great.
It was featured on this Australian design website called the Design Files, and I think they featured my recipes 3 weeks, and every week after they featured, I would sell 300 books.
And wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, it was very powerful. And this was in 2013, I think, it first came out. And then I had all these orders, and I had no more books. And then I was, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? So I was about to press, you know, reorder. I was about to send that email when, out of the blue, I got a call. It was actually a phone call from a woman called Mary Small, and she had seen my book at her friend's house. And that friend was not someone I really knew very well. It was a man that shared an office with one of my customers in Surry Hills, and he had taken the book home, or I'd given him a copy or something on my salad run, and she'd seen it at his house. And it turns out he'd worked in publishing for many years. Mary was one of his colleagues. Mary works in Melbourne. She had come to Sydney, stayed at his house, seen the book, took the book. This is all without me knowing. Taken the book to her publishing meeting, had sold the book to the company. This is Pam Macmillan, so it's a big publisher. And the rest is history. So that book kind of went a little crazy. It really just took off. It really changed the landscape of what a salad is in Australia. People in Australia listening right now, Kerry, are all going to be nodding their heads in recognition. It's become this, it's like an Australian classic. It sold upwards of 80,000 copies.
Wow.
Just,
amazing.
This is just in Australia. It's never been released anywhere else. So I kind of love it that way.
Can you buy it here in America?
No.
You can only buy it in Australia.
It's only ever been released.
Nobody's ever picked it up here?
It's on Amazon. I think people have bought it and are selling it like on the black market, okay. I guess. But it's not, the black market of community. But that book really changed my life. Like I never thought I would write cookbooks. I never thought so many people would love salads. Never thought so many people would love vegetarian salads. But the stories that I've heard from people in Australia it's really humbling to know that so many people have welcomed you into their home. That's how I feel about that book. It's so special to me because of that story, that everything, that kind of happy accident. And then so many people, like, it's all been word of mouth. Like, I don't see myself as ever being a celebrity in Australia. I'd never had a TV show.
Do people know what you look like over there? Like, do you get stopped?
When I was in Sydney last time, I did get stopped once, but it's because I was outside my old house. And actually, the girl walking past had a copy of my book. She'd just gone to buy it. This was family, because family came out a few months ago in Australia. But not really. I'm not like a household face or anything. So for a book that's kind of by, I still say, a known author, to have that kind of traction and that kind of resonance all across Australia, like city, country, old, young.
Amazing.
It's been amazing. It's like a phenomenon.
So why did you leave Australia?
I kind of wanted to try the concept in New York. I kind of wanted to try delivering salads in Brooklyn. I pointedly came to Brooklyn. I thought it was more me. And I did, for the first year, like, I met with a lot of, like, people were so kind when I arrived. Like, I had a lot of coffee dates and everyone was really willing to meet with me. And that's what I find about New York. I mean, everyone is very open to helping. And so I thought maybe I'll open a cafe. I did do salad deliveries for a while.
How'd that go?
It's different. It's really different because I couldn't cook from home. In Sydney, I was registered as a home kitchen, so I did it legally. But here, I worked from Food Works, what was Pilot Works, and it was Food Works originally. So I was like one of the first people that signed on there. And it was really tough, I'm going to be honest. It was not the same to cook from a commercial kitchen. I don't drive here. I don't have a car. So I would get on a subway with all my salads that I'd made at the commercial kitchen, bring them back home, put them on my bike, and cycle them around Carroll Gardens, Cobble Hill.
Like, you take your life in your hands when you ride a bike.
Exactly. I almost died several times.
Yeah.
And like people in Sydney have more time, but what I loved about Arthur Street Kitchen was the chats. So we would stand on the doorstep and talk for 10 minutes. And then
the first time I ever went to Sydney was with Laura Brown.
Uh-huh.
And we went, what's the main park where the Sydney Opera House is?
Oh, Botanic Gardens.
Botanic Gardens. Mm. And so beautiful. And kookaburras. Is
yeah,
that
yeah,
the name
yeah,
of the bird?
Yeah, kookaburras, yeah.
Like, and everybody was jogging.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said to Laura, are all these people unemployed? Like, they're jogging and it's lunchtime. And she's like, no, that's what people do here.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. Because there were so many people out jogging.
Yeah.
I was like, that's incredible. I mean, I think things have changed in New York because lunch options are better. And now you've got Sweet Greens and Dig In and Tender Greens. And you've got really good lunch, Shake Shack, really good lunch choices.
Absolutely.
So at least in New York, I do feel there's this new culture of going out for lunch, whereas people used to sit at their desks and never leave. Yeah, it just seemed like a lot healthier in Sydney in so many respects, that people were actually taking time at lunch to take care of themselves.
Yeah, it's a lot less intense. The way I made salads was, I knew that a lot of the time this was going to be the only break. So me delivering their salad, talking to me on their doorstep, was going to be their only break for the whole day. So I would think about that when I made the salads. I would think about health. They need their vegetables, they need a grain to keep them full. You know, that's how I could kind of, that's the genesis of how I'd come up with the recipes. And it was kind of all from this kind of nurturing viewpoint. It's like, I really want them to be full. And that's probably like my Chinese side coming
up. Goes back to those breakfasts your mom made for you when you were a little kid.
Yeah, I really want people to be like satiated. And so that's kind of how those recipes came about. So
your next cookbook you mentioned is out in Australia.
So,
but it's coming out here.
Well, Neighborhood was my second book. My publishers actually asked me, literally on the eve, my house was all packed up in Sydney and they said, we want you to write the second book. And I'm like, well, I'm about to fly out. We actually left Sydney. We traveled around Europe for 2 months. And so I was like, I don't think I'm ready to really commit. I wanted to write the second book. And funnily enough, I knew it was called Neighborhood before I had the concept of what was going inside. And so when I arrived in New York and we moved into Carroll Gardens, I thought, wow, this is pretty fitting. And so I kind of let myself, so that's what I did. I arrived in that very cold winter of 2015. It was too cold to go outside. My youngest hadn't started school yet, so he was at home. And I just wrote for 3 months, like this book just poured out of me. 3 months, I just wrote every single recipe. And it was, some of it was left over of my recipes from my deliveries in Sydney. A lot of it, when I was in France, we were in France for about a month, and I got so inspired by just shopping from the market and going home and not really having a recipe in mind, but just cooking from whatever fresh produce we got. And it really showed a different side of what you can achieve, like that shop local concept of not really having preconceived recipes, but allowing your environment to dictate what you're going to cook. So in many respects, that's what Neighborhood was about, was like kind of surrendering to your surrounds. And we eat differently here, of course. I mean, we live in a neighborhood that's very Italian focused. I mean, I've never eaten so much mozzarella in my life, but why not? That's what the locals eat. That's what's at our fingertips. I like to not have to travel a long way to get my food. So, you know, it's like allowing your environment to affect what you're eating, which I think is it's a smart way to eat, really.
So tell us about Family, your new cookbook.
So Family is my first book of that is not 100% salads. I call it vegetarian comfort food. It's a bit heavier in respect that there's lots of eggs, and there's a whole egg chapter because eggs is something I grew up with eating and still eat a lot of. There's more cheese. So how the book came about was about 18 months ago, I stopped cooking meat at home. My kids are not vegetarian. They were brought up meat eaters, and I found that I was cooking like three different meals, and I'm like, this is crazy. Like
mom as short order cook.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or I would like, you know, customize things for each child, and I was like, okay, now it's enough. Like they can eat what I eat, but I realized that children don't always want to eat a salad that's got four different types of herbs in them, which is how I would make a salad. And so I sort of approached a bunch of recipes with how am I going to scale this back to make it more approachable. And it's not about cooking for kids. It's not about cooking with kids. It's just about creating recipes that are crowd pleasers, that people, a lot of different palates will love. And so I came up with this set of recipes, which some are recipes I've cooked for many years for my kids, like the gosleme recipe, which we just ate. Yeah, I just kind of thought, what are recipes that my family is going to be able to eat every night? And this is kind of what Family is. That's on the kind of the superficial level of the book. When you dive deeper down, it's me trying to recreate the feeling that I had as a child of sitting down at the table every night. That was the most constant thing in our house. Is my dad worked at the markets, the fruit markets, and so he got up very early. So we'd have very early dinners, 5 p.m. My mum would, you know, yell and kick and scream and make us all come to the table. And it was a constant of my life. And so I was thinking to myself, and particularly after I moved to America, I realized a lot of people don't cook and eat together. And when I started looking at the statistics of how many meals are eaten in the car, for example.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
It's a huge statistic, like 40% of meals are eaten in the car. That's probably not the exact statistic, but it was high. And I started to think to myself, wow, there is a whole generation of families who are missing out on that important mealtime. And it doesn't need to be children. It needs, like, it can be friends. But there's something about sitting down at the table that is such a great equalizer. And it's your time to just talk and laugh. And we used to have arguments at the table in my family. But it's all that. It's what makes us human, is that interaction. And so that's kind of the deeper side of the book, is really giving people recipes. Like, and they're not really, they're kind of simpler recipes, but giving people recipes that they can, that are crowd pleasing and encouraging people to eat together again. Doesn't matter who that's with.
I love that your trilogy is community, neighborhood, family.
Mm. It's getting smaller.
It's getting smaller. But it says a lot about you as a person that those are the titles of your three books.
For me, it's always the recipes are almost secondary to the story. Like for me, every recipe is a story in itself. There's a reason why I would put that in a book. There's a reason why I would cook it. They all mean something to me. So I'm very much story driven, and usually the name of the book is the first thing that comes to me.
I want to hear about your vinaigrettes and your dressings, mm-hmm. because I think that's what trips up a lot of people. And I'm always amazed that people buy bottled salad dressing.
Oh, I don't understand it. Not when you have olive oil and lemon at your fingertips. Like, everybody has that. I mean, that's a dressing in itself. So when I come up with dressings, I love dressings. I think dressings really make a salad. And I think I'm pretty, people love my dressings too. I mean, I do some pretty crazy things with dressings. And I almost don't have, like, you know, a lot of cookbooks, there's like a dressing section. Well, I tailor every dressing to every salad. So, and that's probably just really harking back to my days of actually making salads and delivering them. Like, the dressing is the story. The dressing is what brings, like, that ending to the story, like the happy ending. So I do a lot of, let's have a think. I mean, tahini is probably one of my favorite dressings.
Tell us how you can whip that into a dressing.
So I actually have a hack in family that's like, this is a quick every night. So there's a lot of tailored dressings, but if you don't have a lot of time, I will just put tahini with enough water, because, you know, it seizes. So I think a lot of people freak out with tahini because when you add the water content to it, because the water and then the oil content is out of whack, it will seize. So you just keep adding the water and it will come back smooth. So I'll do that with, you know, like a tiny clove of minced garlic and some lemon. That's probably one of my all-time favorite dressings. Tahini is just, you know, it just adds that. It just feels like exotic when you add that in. And, you know, always I'll add salt and pepper. Salt's my favorite food. So, well, you know, I think in vegetarian cooking, it's all about building layers. And that's one of the really important things about any cooking, really, but particularly vegetables, is you need to add the seasoning mm-hmm. at every point. So at the roasting, add the seasoning, at the, I don't know, pan frying.
And be tasting always.
Always.
Alice Waters always talks about that. Taste, taste,
yeah.
taste.
Yeah. And one of my other favorite things is to really, I do a lot of Asian dressings. And so I do a lot of mashups. One of my favorite dressings actually in Neighborhood, which is the second book, is a mashup of tahini with hoisin sauce. And it's the strangest combination. But that's a direct ripoff from dim sum, because the Chinese serve Chinese sesame sauce with hoisin. So two different, like, it's on separate sides of the plate and you have rice noodles with it. So, and I think I served that with like Brussels sprouts or something. So I
was going through my pantry the other night. I have a bottle of pomegranate molasses that I have neglected. How do I turn that into a salad dressing?
Well, I don't usually use that in a salad dressing. I usually use it on the top of vegetables. Mm. So after you've roasted vegetables, I will do like sprinkling the pomegranate molasses on the top. It's very good with eggplant. So I have
I wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah,
okay.
I have a recipe in my first book, Community, and people in Australia, again, will be nodding their heads. It's a baba ganoush with, you know, like eggplant, and it has I sprinkle the pomegranate molasses over the top with walnuts. It's delicious.
Well, we might have to make that here for lunch one day.
Yeah. Yum. Do you have an open flame? Because I like to do the eggplant on a...
Yeah, no open flame. I mean, we have a stovetop.
That'll work.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. No real open flame then. Yeah. Do you have a barbecue?
I do.
I cook at your place?
I have a barbecue.
Oh, Barbie.
It's kind of, the Barbie is kind of essential to me because I cook a lot of vegetables on the Barbie. And one of my signatures from the first book is the char-grilled broccoli. And a lot of men love that salad because it's kind of revolutionized how you can cook a vegetable. You know how, I don't know if they have it in America, but in Australia, there's this real hierarchy of the barbecue, and the men like to go out to the barbecue and stand around the barbecue and they're doing their meat. But I think it's funny to imagine the men standing there with the broccoli, turning broccoli.
I think think we kind of have that in America too. the whole stereotype of the barbecue.
Totally.
And who can use it? Okay, a few other things we didn't even get to. You have a magazine. Tell everyone about your magazine.
It's called Peddler Journal. It's a multicultural food magazine. It's a recipe-driven magazine. And I started that in 2017. And it draws on memory and tradition. It's very different to other magazines because it's not really current. Like, it's not about trends. It doesn't have chefs in there at all. For me, it's about reverting to the home. Home cooking is really what's inspiring me right now. And I think the reason for that is because I'm away from home. Like, I'm away from my mom and I'm away from the foods that I grew up eating. And whenever I have been away from home, I feel this great pull back to my roots and back to the traditions that I grew up with. So Peddler really, I always wonder whether I would have started it if I still lived in Australia, because I wouldn't have that pull. Here, I'm really like reaching for the memories and the traditions and the rituals of home cooking. And so that's really what Peddler is about. It's about really small stories.
Where can people find it?
PeddlerJournal.com, but it's also in many countries in the world. The stockists will all be on the website.
And then lastly, tell us about your beautiful space up the block.
So I have a space called Neighborhood Studio that's on Atlantic Avenue in Boreham Hill. And I kind of always say this is like the physical manifestation of what I do. It's where I can photograph food, and it's a big test kitchen. So I do, my family was photographed 100% in that studio. People just rent it from us. It's a fully operational kitchen, a huge kitchen island, great for shooting video, like cooking videos. And we also have a prop library, which people can rent from us. And we also have a dining room. So we do a lot of pop-up dinners there.
Very cool. Okay, Hetty, ready for the speed
round? Okay, I'm ready. I'm ready, Kerry.
Okay. Most loved kitchen utensil?
It would be my mum's wok. It's 40 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you take care of it?
So it has to be just be burnt after every, so you don't wash it with any detergent, wipe it out, and then you put it, the water in. So you rinse it out with water, you put it on the stovetop, and then you burn the water off.
Very interesting.
So that's what I do.
Okay. Most treasured cookbook?
Oh, that's so hard. I have a humongous collection. So many. So I would maybe say the cookbook I always turn to when I want inspiration is Breakfast, Lunch and Tea by Rose Bakery.
A song that makes you smile?
Oh, well, I'm an 80s freak because that's showing my age. And 80s music is cool again to my children. So Something by George Michael, because he's my man. Careless Whisper. I'm going to say Careless Whisper. Everyone's going to laugh at that.
Love it. Dream vacation destination?
Oh, I saw a photo of the Maldives this morning and my dream is to go somewhere to stay in one of those overwater bungalows.
Me too. Like
that
Fiji,
is
Fiji, right?
Yep. Tahiti, Maldives. That's my dream.
Call me if you need someone to go with.
Carrie, you and me.
All right. Last question. If you had to be stranded on a desert island with any food celebrity, who would it be and why?
Oh, look, I'm going to say Nigella.
No, good one.
Because I want Nigella to bring one of her books and just read from start to finish, because I just love the way she writes.
And her voice.
Her voice.
She has such a great voice.
Everything. Yes. It's just the full package. So
she would need a lot of sunscreen, though. You would be the one out.
I would be sunning.
Like collecting
food.
I'm fine.
And
things
yeah,
like that.
That's
yeah.
right. Okay. But she can read to me in the, would build her a little alcove with sticks. She can read her books to me.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to Hetty McKinnon for stopping by Cherry Bomb HQ and for bringing us such an incredible lunch. Hetty made us some beautiful food from her new cookbook, Family. Be sure to check it out. Thank you to the excellent folks at Hansabrook Farm Pasture-Raised Organic Eggs for supporting this season of Radio Cherry Bomb. Don't forget our cone-only project. Skip the cup and skip the spoon when getting ice cream this summer. Put less garbage into the world. Go cone only. Radio Cherry Bomb is a production of Cherry Bomb Media. Our theme song is All Fired Up by the band Tra La La, and our show is edited, engineered, and produced by Jess Seidman. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having. Hi, my name is Emma Glubiak, and I work in social media at Apartment Therapy in the Kitchen. Who do I think is the bomb? It's my boss here at the kitchen, Caitlin Garski, who runs all of our social media, because she's not only built an amazing personal brand for herself, but she's also a strong, confident woman to look up to as a role model in my first job.